Okay, I would like to, I forgot to change the title a little bit. I will tell you about many-body localization, what are the big issues, and then I tell you about one approach that I took with several students, PhD students. This is my PhD student, Xiaoxuan Yu, Anirban Gango Padhyay is with Viktor Kalitsky, and Viktor Babs is an Ecole Normale with Francesco Tamponi. They all contributed to different parts. Okay, so I want to start with an informal introduction to Anderson localization in interacting systems and give you a bit of overview of what are all the unresolved issues which are interesting, and then I show you how to approach in particular disordered bosons, hardcore bosons, that is bosons with strong repulsions, that is interactions. And I will focus on trying to understand what is the influence of quantum statistics on localization or delocalization. And actually you might think in a strongly insulating regime, strongly disordered regime, what does quantum statistics do? Maybe almost nothing, but it turns out that there are lots of interesting effects that you will see. Okay, now more precisely, we'll talk about dirty bosons and actually dirty hardcore bosons, and that those arise. For example, in experimental systems, it's believed that in indium oxide, a certain compound, even if you turn this superconducting material insulating by disorder or by thickness, it retains some local Cooper pairing and is actually an insulator of bosons of preformed pairs. Such things also arise if you have, in general, negative U-Hubbard interactions. Then you form pairs of fermions and you get hardcore bosons. Mann and Lieber probably the first one to look at such a model theoretically. And what we do also applies to granular superconductors, to cold bosonic atoms in this order, maybe helium, etc., etc., quantum spin system. Okay. Now, before we go to bosons, let me remind you a little bit what Anderson localization is and then how it generalizes in a many-body context. Okay, so Anderson tried to understand actually a many-body system like spin diffusion in a disordered medium, but then he realized it's very hard and he went to the single particle fermionic problem where you have disorder potentials and hopping. So you have a lattice with a disorder potential on all sides and you have hopping from side to side. And the basic thing that happens is that if you have strong disorder, then all atomic orbitals are more or less localized and do not hybridize with their neighbors. Only occasionally this happens, that is indicated here by these hybridization clouds. And so if you diagonalize this Hamiltonian, you find all wave functions localized, all eigenfunctions are localized. If you tune the disorder down or the hopping up, then these resonances or hybridizations proliferate and eventually they percolate, and that gives rise to delocalization of eigenfunctions.
But you don't really mean equality here, equal to calculation of resonances.
No, but it's a very useful way of thinking about it. Actually.
Not in 2D.
No, not in 2D, but say that's what Anderson was basically having in mind.
I got the impression though that as an estimate of where Anderson transition happens, the calculation picture is pretty good.
Yes, that's pretty good indeed, yes. Mm-hmm.
So in high dimensions. In
yes. High dimensions. And so I show that also because this is the way people think about in many body systems.
But how can you quantify this? So resonances, by resonances you mean perfect resonances?
You mean delta epsilon between two sides is smaller than the hopping, maybe smaller than the bandwidth. If you choose the right numbers here but judiciously, you get a quite good estimate in three dimensions of the localization threshold. Okay, so how does this look like? So if the disorder is weak, you look at eigenfunctions, they look like distorted plane waves which are extended. If you have strong disorder, the eigenfunctions are localized and they decay with an exponentially decaying envelope in space. As a function of energy, say in three dimensions, what usually happens is that the band edges look like this, are localized, and in the middle you have delocalized or extended states. And then if you look into transport, your Fermi level is in here, then you have a metallic behavior, the conductivity is good down to zero temperature. If your Fermi level is in here, then you have transport only via activation to the mobility edge here, or if you have phonons, then you have inelastic scattering, and then you have hopping conductivity. And depending on how strong the disorder is, you can either have some extended states in the middle or nothing at all, and everything is localized. Okay, so this is very well understood. Now, recently, people have been interested in the question of what happens in interacting systems. So you can approach that in various ways, but the convenient way of thinking about it is you take first the single particle part of the Hamiltonian, you diagonalize it, and you get some localized orbitals. You assume the disorder is strong enough to localize all single particle orbitals. And that's the basis in which you work. And now you write down the interactions in this localized basis. And so you get the four fermion term, for example. And this is the matrix element of the interactions in this basis. And here you have a disordered energy for each eigenstate that is either occupied or empty. And now you can think of this Hamiltonian as, a hopping Hamiltonian with disorder and hopping. And the hopping now is a hopping in Fock space. So the sites on which you can sit are occupation states in this non-interacting basis. And the interaction term takes you from one Fock state to another by taking two particles and putting them somewhere else. Okay, and now you would like to understand whether the interactions or this hopping in Fock space somehow delocalizes you, or whether you retain localization in the many-body context. That's the big question. Okay. And why is localization so interesting? Because it actually has very profound impacts on transport. Now let me discuss that in more detail. The question is particularly interesting if you think about quantum particles with nothing else. And with nothing else, I mean there is no bus that can delocalize you. So there are no phonons, there is no electromagnetic field or other gauge fields that are continuous degrees of freedom, which, if you couple to them, will delocalize you immediately. And so the conceptual question becomes not sharp and not so interesting. So I want to ask, what happens if I have just quantum particles, say, on a lattice, and nothing else? Can these particles form themselves a bus, like phonons are, or not? And to answer this question, or to look at an interesting consequence of the answer, is to look at transport as a function of temperature. Now, as a warm-up, let's just do the exercise for non-interacting fermions, where we understand everything. So here is temperature, here is disorder. As I showed you before, there is a critical disorder where the whole band of states localizes and all wave functions look like this, exponentially decaying. Then if you don't have phonons and no other bus, then the diffusion constant and conductivity are zero at all temperatures. So you apply an electric field, nothing happens. There is no dissipation, nothing. And in particular, if you now make a local perturbation, you put a particle somewhere, this particle will not diffuse. And if you watch a film of this, you will see that the density is not going out ad infinitum, but somehow you will see quasi-periodic motion. So after a while, you cannot even tell that the time goes forward or backward if you look if you watch the film backward. So that's a very interesting phenomenon that happens. We understand it now, but it's really something profound. Okay, if you're on this side, then there are some extended states somewhere, maybe at the Fermi level, maybe somewhere else, and that always gives you finite transport. If the Fermi level is in the extended states regime, then it's metallic, otherwise it's just activated, but it's always finite.
When you say zero in a finite size system, what is zero?
Zero would mean exponentially small in the linear size of the system.
Even on the many-body local
Yes, yeah, I think so.
If there is no bus, so how can it be activated?
Sorry?
If there's no any bus, how can it be activated?
No, here, if you have a mobility edge somewhere, then...
Yeah, right, then somebody should...
But if you then you have a bus up there, so you have some excitations in the thermodynamic limit which are activated up there. They have a continuous spectrum. They pollute everybody. So all levels.
You provide this excitation.
Yeah. But so these are the delocalized states at high energy, which are always populated with a small but finite probability, and they give level width to everybody. So at finite temperature, if you have somewhere a continuum at finite energies, then you will have transport. Okay, so this is fully understood. Maybe mathematicians are not yet happy about this side, but we are physicists. And what is known is that if you don't have special symmetries in 2D or certainly also in 1D, basically this critical disorder is at zero. And as soon as you have a little bit of disorder, everything localizes in the thermodynamic limit. Okay. Now, the real interesting question nowadays, I guess, is many-body systems. So again, I have an interacting particle system and nothing else. And the important is that it's not just two or three particles, but a finite density. Okay. And again, my phase diagram temperature disorder here is infinite temperature. What people believe is that if you make disorder sufficiently strong, then you can also fully localize such a many-body system that is over here somewhere. There will be a phase where there is no transport, no diffusion whatsoever, even at infinite temperature. And this point has in particular been made by Vadim and David Hughes using techniques that previously were used by Berkowitz and Shklovsky, looking at level statistics in a many-body system. On the other hand, over here, when disorder is not very strong, you believe there is a metallic regime. And what Vasco, Alena, and Altschuler were providing in 2005 is a prediction that there should be a phase transition here between a phase that has finite transport to a phase that has absolutely no transport if you don't include phonons. Okay? But none of the aspects of this phase diagram are really rigorously understood, or namely, you can ask what is the role of dimension? Is one and two dimensions again special? Can you have this phase transition as a function of temperature, meaning a line like this, or does it have to be vertical actually, at least in high dimensions? I believe it should be vertical, but I cannot prove that.
So, are you going to give us arguments why it should be?
No, I gave you arguments, I think, 2 years ago, and I have not much more progress on that. But, I mean, there is no numerical evidence to support either of the two.
Well, why vertical? I guess, if you take a single particle spectrum that's fully localized,
yes,
a large enough disorder in many dimensions.
Okay, so
can we move from there to the right?
Right. So you could think that it is not possible to have a high temperature conducting phase and a low temperature non-conducting phase, because locally, even at this temperature down here, you could have a bubble that looks like high temperature, and this bubble cannot diffuse because it wouldn't have a thermal conductivity by assumption. But yet you would conclude, doing an analysis like Baskin-Altschuler, that this would actually travel around. And then you could try to argue that there's a contradiction of having such a phase transition. Yeah, OK. So I'm just saying this is an open issue.
Baskin-Altschuler, they predict?
They predict something like this, yeah. I mean, very rough estimate of where this happens. Actually, it should happen at level spacing divided by undimensional strength of interaction. That is their prediction. And if that scale becomes of the order of the bandwidth, then you get up to that point. Okay, so this is an open question. Another open question is whether there are actually two transitions. One where you go from no transport to some transport, but you're still not ergodic in the sense that if you start from an initial condition, even in the infinite time limit, you're not fully exploring the phase space consistent with energy conservation, but you are only exploring a certain subspace, like in glasses. So there could be a transition like that, and nobody knows whether there are transitions or crossovers, and whether actually such second line even exists. Third thing is, if you have such a transition line, and you have a transition into a phase here, where you have finite transport at any finite temperature, then what happens actually down here? And this is particularly interesting for bosons. So let's zoom in down there and not talk about temperature, but about finite energy above the ground state. And let me discuss a situation where I have, when I reduce the disorder, a delocalized phase, meaning that above the ground state, I have excitations that are delocalized at arbitrarily low energies. So that happens, for example, in a superfluid because I have Goldstone modes, or in a meton. Okay? And now I want to know how this localized phase here is approaching, actually. And there are three scenarios that I can imagine. Either there's a mobility edge which separates delocalized and localized excitations, which comes right down to zero here. And then the delocalized spectrum just joins the delocalized spectrum over here. Or you have a mobility edge like that. This is localized, finite energy excitations are localized, and then you have a continuum, and that stops at the finite energy here, and then all of a sudden you get a continuum because, for example, you form a superfluid. Or, as some people believe, you go immediately into a phase where everything is localized up to an extensive energy. And the mobility edge would be proportional to the volume of the system. Okay? And again, the answer is not known, but what I will present you today is our approach to trying to understand what happens at very low temperature and what happens in particular as I approach a superfluid from a Bose glass. So dirty bosons with interactions coming from this side, making an expansion at large disorder. Okay, and the bottom line will be, out of these three scenarios, the second or third seem to be holding. So either you have an extensive mobility edge immediately, or you have a mobility edge that somehow exists but is not related to the onset of order and of, say, superfluidity, but this generically doesn't seem to happen. I don't know whether it never happens. I would be interested in hearing your opinion about that. Okay. So what are the particular questions I want to address? As I promised, I want to show you that quantum statistics has actually interesting effects in insulators, which you might maybe not expect. Then I will discuss how to describe strong localization in interacting disordered systems, actually generalizing Anderson's approach to fermions. And then in special cases, I can push this approach close to delocalization, and that will give this answer of these two and three scenarios. Good. Okay. So the simplest possible model that I can envision is a model where I have just the disorder potential and hopping kinetic energy. And if these here are fermions, this is the standard Anderson model that was analyzed over 50 years ago, and it's non-interacting. But if these are hardcore bosons, for example, then we are dealing with an interacting problem because the bosons repel each other on each side, and that's a true interaction effect. Okay, so if I have hardcore bosons, the commutation relations are they commute, not anti-commute, and locally they have this funny commutation relation, which is not 1 as in fermions, but has this 2n-1, which is either -1 or +1, depending on whether the site is occupied or not. Incidentally, since we're in Santa Barbara, I also notice you can do that for anions in two dimensions, and they smoothly interpolate between fermions and bosons in two dimensions. Okay. Now, as I said, I want to talk about strongly disordered insulators. So the disordered part is the leading part, and I want to make an expansion in the hopping. And if I talk about such strong insulators, we know that transport at low temperatures will be of hopping type activated, and the key characteristic is actually the localization length. The localization length tells you how the wave functions decay in space. And for fermions, that's a very simple concept. You look at the Green's function, essentially. You put the particle somewhere on site zero at the time t prime. You take it out at site I later, and you ask how big this Green's function is. So this will decay exponentially in this distance. And the time dependence allows you to probe a certain frequency. So you look how you propagate at different energies. That's very well defined in single particle systems. If you want to talk about multi-particle systems, something very similar applies, but you have to take into account that it's not, well, you will see all the interaction effects. So again, we will define the spatial decay of the Green's function as defining a localization length. And indeed, that will determine what happens in transport. So if I say spatial decay of correlation functions or Green's functions, what I actually mean is I look how this decays, but I take the logarithm, I average the logarithm, so I ask for the typical decay, not for the average decay, and I take a large distance and I divide by the distance. And the rate by which this decays, that is the so-called localization length. Now for fermions, I just remind you, if you look at this localization length as a function of energy and you go close to the Fermi level and a bit away from it, nothing much happens with this localization length. For bosons, it's not so clear, because for bosons, zero energy is something special, as we will see. And we'll see there is a energy dependence to the localization length. You may already guess what this energy dependence is. And if you work like me, then you will make a wrong guess now, and you will see the right answer later. OK. So how do we calculate this stuff, actually? I use here a technique which I discovered after having thought for a few months along other lines, and it was very tedious to figure out how to calculate these Green's functions. But then I found out that John Hubbard, when first thinking about the Hubbard model, had developed a very elegant and very efficient tool to compute these Green's functions. Namely, you look at the equation of motion that the Green's function satisfies. So you just take the time derivative, you subtract the local part that is trivial coming from the local disorder, and then you get a simple delta function from the retarded theta function, and then a piece that comes from the hopping to the neighboring sites. And so this sets up a very simple fashion of doing perturbations here in the hopping. Okay? And I'm interested in evaluating this Green's function perturbatively in the hopping, and then go to higher and higher orders in principle. Now, if you do that systematically and you iterate, you just go to Fourier space, and then you plug in this side to that side, and you get the iteration equation. Then you get the famous sum over pass that was already in Anderson's paper and probably known already before, namely that the Green's function from 0 to I can just be written as a sum over all paths that go from 0 to I of terms along each path, of a product of hopping and the locator. And the locator is just the inverse of this local Green's function here. And so this is clearly perturbative expansion, the hopping, and expresses conveniently this Green's function. Now for fermions, it has been known for more than 50 years, and then has been exploited later on by Spivak, Shklovsky, and Wen to look at strong insulators. For strong insulators, fermionic insulators, you can ask how much does the wave function decay from here to here. Well, if you have to sum over all paths and the hopping is very small, then you better take just the shortest path to go from here to here. But that's not such a trivial problem, because here already you see there are 6 different paths to go from here to here. And if you make the distance large, there are exponentially many paths that you can take. And you have to sum them up, and they all interfere, determining the wave function amplitude, so to speak. So you should think of this Green's function sort of as a wave function amplitude of a wave function which is centered at site zero. The GR tells me how much the amplitude is over here at site I at this frequency.
Excuse me. Mm-hmm. In what way the work of Spivak-Shklovsky and Guyon is really for fermions? I mean, this is a single particle.
It's and single.
Statistics is not, does not enter there.
Yes, so it's but a single particle. So if you're talking about fermions, don't have to care about the fact that there are other fermions. But if you talk about bosons, you will have to care about others being there. And then this is not the correct formula anymore. Now I show you what happens for bosons. Right. So after a brief discussion, namely, one thing that you may ask, how can I probe this interference of many paths? As you know, interference is very sensitive to magnetic fields. So you can ask, what happens if I pierce now magnetic fields over here? Then these paths acquire a Aronoff-Bohm phase, and the interference pattern changes. And that shows up in a very sensitive response of this Green's function amplitude at a certain distance. And what those authors actually focused on is that the localization lengths tends to increase if you punch in a magnetic field. And the physics behind that is just that every now and then there are some relevant amplitudes here that interfere destructively. You see here there are random signs that can occur here. So certain paths come with positive signs, certain with negative signs. And so every now and then, two paths just cancel. If you put the magnetic field, then they acquire a complex phase, and this cancellation becomes harder. And therefore, on average, the propagation amplitude becomes bigger because you have less such cancellation. Okay, that was a big revolution, a very nice discovery of these authors, and stimulated a lot of work then. So now let's see what happens if we change the statistics and we look at the interacting problem of hardcore bosons. Now, just do the same thing. I write the equation of motion for the Green's function. But now when I take the time derivative, I have to commute the annihilation operator with the Hamiltonian from the time derivative. And the commutation relation now gives me a factor minus 1 to the n, or which is the same as 2n minus 1 that I showed you before. So here, at this point, statistics enters. And for anions, you would get something that has the anion phase in here. Okay. So everything stays the same. Now, from here to here, I have to make an approximation. Namely, I have to say I want to work in the lowest order in hopping. Then I can decouple in this average this term from that term, and I can just take the expectation value of this term. And that results in a simple phase here in this recursion relation. But apart from this sign, everything is the same as for fermion. So it looks very innocuous, but it actually has profound consequences. So if I iterate that, and then I get again a sum over all paths, and the sum is rigorously exact for all shortest paths or for all paths that don't self-intersect. And the only difference with fermions is this sign here, which comes from the statistics.
Yeah, so now you made a mistake, right, in a sense, because you made a linear in T approximation first, and then you work in that approximation to all orders in T.
No, okay, so I say I want a Green's function very far at a small hopping, and I want the leading term in hopping. So I need at least as many hoppings that it takes me to go from this side to that side. So So I take each link just once, and in that limit, this is exact.
Okay? I think we're almost doing this in failure.
Yeah. Okay. So now we have a sum over paths with this sign in there. And notice a very interesting fact. If I take omega to zero, that means if I probe wave functions that have zero energy, so very shallow excitations, then these factors are all positive. So I just get 1/ absolute value of epsilon. So now, in distinction with fermions, all paths come with positive amplitudes at low energy, right? If I go to high energies, it's like I look at the single particle problem, and of course it looks exactly the same as for fermions, right? That's a good sign. But at low energies, the bosons really know about the statistics, and it's very different from fermions, in that these amplitudes are all positive. And if you want to just by hand understand why there is this sign coming from, then you can take two paths, one like this and one like that, and you take this forward and that backward, and you ask what happens if I give a particle in here, I take it out here, and now I put it back in here, I go through here and go back out. What actually happens microscopically is that you have indistinguishable particles, and you move all the particles that sit on this path, and you move them one slot to the right, and then you move them on another path back, and actually you make a ring exchange, right? And the ring exchange, we know, should differ by -1 to the number of particles if you compare fermions and bosons. And that is exactly what this thing is doing, because you get the -1 for every side that has negative energy, because on every side with negative energy, there is a particle sitting. And so this factor must be there. If you trust in the fermionic result, looking at Anderson's paper, you would know immediately that for bosons, there should be this factor.
Sorry, but now your particle are two bosons.
Hardcore bosons, yes.
No, the new one. I mean,
yes?
Your approximation is like they're bosons, right?
Hardcore bosons, yeah. The Bs, these Bs are hardcore bosons, or spin 1/2.
Yeah, but there's no such there's no such thing like a free model for hardcore bosons. So since solve your model.
No, wait. So
there's no weak expansion.
This is not exact to all orders. This is exact in the leading order of Hopping. So if I am at large distance n, I get the term t to the n. And to that order, this is exact. If I ask about higher order corrections, then they become more and more involved. They can also be computed, but it's not that I can solve that like a fermion problem. But I can make an expansion in Hopping. And I learn already a whole lot from this expansion. Okay. So in particular, the simplest thing that comes to mind is what happens when you have now magneto resistance. You plug in a magnetic field again, and you ask, how does it affect interference? And the effect is very easy to understand. If, say, we are at omega equals to zero, all these amplitudes were positive. Now I give complex amplitudes to all paths, then of course the interference will not be as perfect anymore as before. And that means the sum over paths is not as big anymore as before when I square it, when I square the absolute value of the amplitude. And that means that the propagation from zero to I will be smaller, and that means the localization length has decreased. Whereas for fermions, it increased. So you see that the quantum statistics gives qualitatively different magneto response. Yeah?
So, for simple particles, localization is a consequence of destructive interference due to this. So, at least that's where I always thought. Now you're saying that for bosons, you only have constructive interference. So, can you prove localization in this, dirty bosons?
Well, proof is a bit a strong word, but I mean, you can certainly convince yourself that when t is very small, then this is exponentially small as I go to large distance, and this has an exponential decay with distance. You can just, in principle, you can put it on the computer and you can see it very easily. Okay. But also you can sort of, I guess you can sort of estimate, you know, what is the probability of this to become extremely large and compensate something which is very small here.
Do you agree with me that the usual sort of reason why, you know, people accept Anderson's result in that, you know, because of destructive interferences? So here you
know. No, I don't agree with that. No.
No,
because Anderson was just asking what is the distribution of such a term here.
Yeah.
He didn't ask about the sum. Actually, he argued the sum is dominated by the largest term, basically. And then he said, so what is the distribution of this largest
thing? That series was asymptotic because of the silver.
Yes, but the essential argument was that this thing has heavy tails and the tail is dominating what happens. Actually, I think he was actually anticipating fractality in some sense. He knew that this sum is not at all a homogeneous sum, but there's one term which is particularly large. Of course, there are correlations between these terms and that he neglected, but somehow you're going into a preferential direction, and then the thing becomes very similar with bosons. Okay. But you really don't have to worry that this converts if the hopping is small.
There is another way to understand this, say, negative Nogato resistance in the case of fermions. Mm-hmm. This is when you start from the direction of a very weak disorder.
Yep.
You have two trajectories that return to the origin, Cooper-like,
mm-hmm.
and they enhance the backscattering. When you apply magnetic field, you destroy this enhanced backscattering, meaning you have negative magnetic resistance.
So can you
talk about this positive magneto resistance of bosons in the same language? I mean, the viewpoint of a return problem.
Yeah, it's a good point. So, so let me first say, Spivak and Shklovsky made a strong point that their effect is different from this weak localization effect. So it is similar but different because you don't come back to the same point. It's about interference of. Okay, you could say it's very similar, but this return probability is very important for fermions because you have different signs on this path and on this path, for example, and therefore if this point is not equal to that point, then there is no particular reason why this should interfere constructively with that. However, if this point is equal to that point, then such a path is a closed loop. And this closed loop has the same amplitude as the reverse path. And therefore, you have constructive interference only when you come back to the origin. And that is destroyed then by a magnetic field, because then the amplitudes become different for time reverse path. But for bosons, exactly this thing doesn't work, because bosonic paths interfere constructively both when you come back to the same point as when you go to another point, because all amplitudes are positive anyway. And so you can say, well, what happens for bosons is the same thing as happens for fermions for the return probability to the origin, but it just happens for all propagation in some sense. And the fact that it happens for all propagation from A to B and not just from A to A is one way of seeing that that weak localization is not such a big problem for bosons, and why bosons can become superfluid in two dimensions while fermions don't.
But can I ask? There should be some kind of sum rule there, because if you ask for the probability to go from 0 to R and somehow equal R, you'd better get 1.
Right.
So that sounds all right for fermions, because you're saying you get a decrease if R is different from 0 and an increase if R is the origin. But I don't see how that's working for bosons.
Yeah, well, okay. I think it eventually this is a qualitative type of argument. I mean, it just helps you a bit understand what is happening. But I don't think the level of And I'm not sure there's a sum rule here because you have a many particle system, and I'm not sure that the Green's function satisfies the sum rule, but we could check later.
Can I just ask So in this approach, you can estimate what the localization length is as a function of hopping.
Yes. Yeah, as a function of
logarithmic with the hopping, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Is that correct? So for fermions, for weak hopping, can you establish by independent means that the localization length is logarithmic hopping? What little corrections do some?
Ah, okay. Yeah, there are some corrections. So the, on the leading order, you just say there's just a logarithmic term, and I can take this t out as long as it doesn't depend on the bond. It's just t to the n times something. But there are, because of these resonances that you can have when the denominator here becomes very small, then you have to go to higher orders, and there hopping enters non-trivially, and there are the corrections there. Okay. Now, just a quick experimental flash. I believe that what we established so far, that bosons and fermions react completely differently to magnetic fields, may be a key element in understanding experiments in indium oxide, where they drove a superconductor insulating by a magnetic field. And the belief is that in this particular material, bosons, meaning preformed pairs, survive for a while in the field, and then they are turned into unpaired fermions. And in the meantime, you get a huge magnetoresistance peak, because now comes the theoretical interpretation, at least a part of it might be that bosons shrink their wave function with the magnetic field, while when you get fermions, they expand their wave function again. And that shows up as an exponential effect in resistance. That's certainly not the whole thing that is going on here, but it may be, a part of the story. Okay. Now, can we say something more quantitative than just qualitative? Now, I show you something which tells you something interesting about the structure of wave functions in general in such insulators. And to put that in context, let me quickly go back to some of the history. In particular, Karda has picked up on this Spivak-Shklovsky business and did a lot of numerics together with Medina. It's also in his textbook, where they try to understand how this sum over pass behaves as a function of magnetic field. And what you find in the papers and in the book is some not so satisfactory data fitting. And in particular, so there were some power laws in small field and large field, small distance, large distance. But you see the data collapse is not very satisfactory. And I think it is all due to the fact that some basic physics was actually missed in this sum over path. Analytically, there was very little comprehension, in particular about magnetoresistance. There is essentially nothing. What people concentrated on, like Derrida and co-workers, was trying to understand what thermodynamic phases you can have if you have a large sum over weights that are actually complex weights.
Is the y-axis on that curve?
Sorry?
It's the y-axis.
Oh, that is B field times distance to
y-axis.
This was the logarithm of the sum over pass. So this is actually the the change in the logarithm of the sum over pass. The sum over pass is something exponentially large or exponentially small. And then you ask, how does this change when I apply a field? If I apply no field, there's no change, and then there's a change. And then you ask how it works. Okay. Good. So we also looked...
That was a numerical study.
That was all numerics. So we also first started off doing numerics. And what you find that at large distance, actually, is that the change in the logarithm of the Green's function, so the change in the decay of the Green's function, is again proportional to r. Not only you know that log g is proportional to r, it has an exponential decay, but this change is also proportional to r. And that means that you have a change in localization length due to the magnetic field. The question is, what is this power law of the magnetic field here? And what I showed you before is this not so satisfactory trial to collapse that to some power law. And the trouble is that fermions behave very, very in a complicated fashion because there are these positive and negative amplitudes in the sum over path. We notice that if you analyze bosons, it's much easier. And the reason is that bosons at low frequencies, zero frequency, have only positive weights. And so the sum over paths that are directed, that means they are shortest between site I and J, those paths look like directed polymers with positive weights. So this is like a stat-mec problem, actually, if you look at the sum over all these paths. And so we can use directly what is known on directed polymers in random media. So you look at the sum as a partition function in statistical mechanics. And a lot is known about the structure of directed polymers. Those of you that are experts know, of course, that there is a non-trivial structure of how typically the dominant paths meander here in this plane. And unlike what has always been assumed by Carder and Spivak and Shklovsky and so on, that these paths are just random walks in this plane, they are actually much rougher than random walks. They have excursions here that grow with this length scale, like L to the 2/3 instead of L to 1/2. And that reflects in the magnetoresistance.
Could I ask something about that?
Yeah.
Previous picture. So, I mean, the whole way that you get many directed paths in the same length is from deciding to look at propagation along the diagonal of the lattice. If you look at propagation along one of the principal axes,
then there's one
allow fluctuations in the length of the path in order to
right.
get anything happening at all. So that suggests that we should also allow fluctuations in this geometry.
Yeah, that is in principle a true remark. We chose this geometry because that's what Spivak and Shklovsky were also doing. And the idea is that if you make this lattice a bit disordered, you restore isotropy. And actually, if you allow for the next but shortest path or paths that are a bit longer but not too much longer, then it doesn't matter whether you go this direction or that direction eventually. And still you have a directed motion and in a continuum limit it will still map to the same universality class.
But here you allow only for the shortest path, yes?
Yeah. And we go onto the diagonal to get the non-trivial problem. So there are n over n half possible paths. The dominant ones will be somehow in a cigar shape here, and the cigar shape has a width which is length to the 2/3.
In the Spivak, it was L to the 1/2?
Yeah, that was always assumed that it's L to 1/2, right? Okay.
Well, assumed and the.
Assumed.
Manifested as well.
They thought that they fitted their data to this assumption and it didn't quite work. And then, yeah. Okay. Okay, if I want to understand that more analytically, let me go through that a bit quickly. I cannot analyze the sum over paths, of course, as you may imagine. Yeah.
So the question is, if you were to sort of explain why the random walk assumption breaks down in a continuum model that has no lattice, nice sort of regularization properties, is it easy to see why if I just write down a...
At large scale, you will see that it's always good for a path to look for the best disorder, because that gives you more energy than you pay in elastic energy, in entropy of paths. So that is known as the Larkin length. Above the Larkin length, you want to choose the better disorder, and you have a competition between elasticity and disorder. So disorder is pushing you to explore more into faraway regions.
So these properties come from essentially rare events which come in any really sort of
If you want. So it's a disorder dominated rough pinned phase. It's a true glassy phase. It's like surface roughness in KPZ. It's the same universality class as KPZ equation. Okay. So the directed polymers tell us that actually dominant paths in this sum form certain loops, and these loops have non-trivial scaling properties. And that suggests a droplet-like picture, which was put forward by Fisher and Hughes, also in the context of spin glasses, but also in this context. And what we did is formalize that to form a toy model where we can actually calculate analytically the magnetoresistance. Okay, and the idea is just that you can I want to look at paths from this side to this side, and I say, okay, there can be two branches of paths. They form some loop, and along these branches of paths, there are sub-branches of paths that form sub-loops, etc., etc., and they are all going to be pinched by a magnetic field. And what I want to understand is how the sum along all these loops and sub-loops is affected by the magnetic field. And so we define a hierarchical model of loops like that. We take first the biggest loop, we split it in the dominant, the subdominant loop, then into smaller loops, etc. And we assign to those statistical weights, namely we say that the sum along all paths scales like a certain dominant term, which we take to be 1, and the subdominant term, which we know from directed polymer theory how it scales with the length of this loop, namely scales like length to the 1/3. And we know what is the typical area of such a loop enclosed. That will be the length times the transverse length, which is L to the 2/3. And that defines how a magnetic field acts on this sum over path. So I don't want to go into more details here. The thing is, we found an analytically tractable model for where we can get the magnetoresistance in a virial expansion in small b. This is possible because when you have small magnetic field, you need big loops to get a significant interference. Big loops have a very small probability that the two branches come with comparable weights. So these loops are very rare. So if you look at the long distance, you have only very sparse loops that contribute. And so you can make a virial expansion, a low density expansion. And then we check that numerically, this model and the full model give very similar results. And so we are pretty confident that we capture all the relevant physics. OK. Now, I already explained that since you have disorder domination, it's not at all random walks, but you have to look for loops that are significantly affected by a magnetic field. That means there should be one flux going through such a loop. That means field times area should be 1. That gives you a typical length scale. And then you ask, how many loops of this length scale do you have along the line or per unit length? And that gives you an order of magnitude estimate of what will be the change in in localization length, because each of these relevant loops will decrease the decay rate by the total decay by a factor of order of 1, and therefore the density of these loops is proportional to the change in the localization length. Okay, and by putting together the roughness exponent, which controls this width, and the exponent that controls the density of these relevant loops, you get immediately a non-trivial exponent for the magnetoresistance, which is 4/5. So the change of localization length goes like b to the 4/5. And for bosons, you get a minus sign, and for fermions, you get a plus sign if you apply this model.
And these experiments are all for two-dimensional systems.
This is two dimensions. In three dimensions, we still believe that these expressions here apply, where zeta and theta are the energy and the roughness exponents of a one plus two-dimensional directed polynomial. Okay, just to show you that this works very well, the scaling of the same quantity as Medina-Carter plotted with distance and divided by magnetic length follows exactly the power loss that you expect from this picture.
But, Marcus, you said it was an expansion for small b.
No. Well, yeah, small b, but then we go to very large distance.
Okay.
Good. So a last remark here is if you compare the effect on fermions to the effect on bosons, here I show you the change in total decay, so which is proportional to the distance, so you just see straight lines. If you look at the scale here I have fermions, here I have bosons, you see that the effect on bosons is much stronger than the effect on fermions. That's basically because bosons have these positive amplitudes, which you destroy very significantly with the magnetic field. For fermions, the effect is more subtle. And therefore, for bosons, you can expect a resistance change due to magnetic field, which can be two orders of magnitude in realistic cases. So it's really a very sizable effect. Okay. Now that was sort of a digression into a magnetic field response. Now we want to come back maybe to the bigger question of many-body localization and what happens in particular as I take my bosons towards delocalization, meaning towards the superfluent. And you can think that if you have a strong disorder phase and you make it, you drive it toward the superfluid, it's somehow a boson delocalization plus condensation into a delocalized state. But how does this happen exactly? There are several proposals in the literature as to what might happen. So there is one recent work by Alain Archula and Shlyapnikov who concentrated first on the one dimension, said, again, there's a strongly disordered phase and a conducting phase. Up here, they predict, as before with Basco, a finite temperature transition, and then they conjecture that this finite temperature, critical temperature, goes all the way down to the critical point where you have a transition between the insulator and the superfluent. So they would favor the what I call scenarios three, where all excitations up to an extensive value, up to a finite temperature, are localized as soon as you're in the insulator. Then they had some arguments why they believed also that this conjecture should be true in two dimensions. Right. But then, going back into the literature, you can find the opposite kind of argument by Anderson, Hertz, and Fleischmann in a paper called Marginal Bose Class, where they were thinking of how do dirty ordered phases appear as you come from the disordered phase. They were sort of making Hartree-Fock-like arguments, and they speculated that there is in the Hartree-Fock spectrum, there will be a localized tail of modes, of the low soft modes, and only when the mobility edge in the spectrum of modes becomes softer and softer and eventually touches zero, then you get your ordering transition and condensation. That would mean that there are finite energy modes which are already delocalized, and as you approach the transition, it's just that these finite energies come down to zero. So that's a very different scenario. And this scenario seemed to be corroborated by a study on the Bethe lattice by Joffe Mezar and then later on by Feigelman, of the simplest possible model, namely this hardcore model, hardcore bosons in disorder, on a Bethe lattice. Namely, what they proposed is that there's a superfluid phase with a TC, then TC goes down to zero, and then there's an insulating phase where there's a finite mobility edge of excitations that eventually tends to infinity, so forget about this part, here it diverges, and then it would be completely localized. So that would be scenario one. But with our technique, we can revisit that, and we found this a simple error in the perturbation theory that was done. This is not the correct scenario that happened. So instead, what we'll see is that in this particular model, as you come to that point, there's just no delocalized excitations anymore over here. Okay. And a glimpse of this physics you can also find in finite dimensions, not only on the Bethe lattice. In finite dimensions, if you look at this sum over parts and you look at finite frequencies now, then you see that the frequencies, if the frequency is bigger than the local energy, then you get a negative sign here, no? And that means that at finite frequencies, the sum over parts is not over only positive amplitudes. And therefore, you expect that the localization lengths for finite frequencies will be shorter than at zero frequency. And indeed, if you put that on the computer and you logarithmically average that, here I plot the inverse localization length as a function of frequency, minus the one at zero, and you see that at zero you get the strongest propagation, and then you get the localization length, or inverse localization length, that increases, meaning the wave functions retract.
Okay. Are you plotting just to really contribute?
Yeah, so I'm just plotting what I get from this here. We're trying to go to higher orders, but it's very difficult to figure out how to do that in a controlled manner. So this is more of a suggestion that indeed you should maybe expect that this happens, that you delocalize best at zero energy and not at finite energy. And to most people, this comes very much as a surprise, because you would say, well, if I have very little energy, there are very few states that I can hybridize with, and I should be more localized. It's like I'm at the band edge of a fermionic problem. And if I go to in the middle of the band, I have many more states, and so I could delocalize much more easily. So everybody naturally would say, I expect this kind of behavior. But that's not what happens. But if you're more educated or come from a different angle, then you know that some things like this also happen in exactly solved models. For example, in 1D, there's a closely related problem, the random transverse field easing model, which is like the Hartree boson problem, which is a spin 1/2 problem. But instead of XY exchange, I have just XX exchange. That can be solved exactly by mapping to fermions. And lo and behold, if you look at the localization length of these fermions, which are in a class BD1, they are most delocalized at zero energy because of a Dyson singularity. But there seems to be some particular physics here that makes that happen, maybe more generally.
But in the fermion chain, you understand what the symmetry is that makes the localization
that
at zero energy. And do you have any comparable symmetry here?
Well, that's what I'm trying to understand. Probably some kind of emergent particle hole symmetry.
Isn't there a worry that you've left some terms out of this expansion, and
that that's
maybe the
result
is an artifact of leaving those terms out?
That, well, yeah, it could be. I mean, I would like to discuss that more with you, actually, but. We can do the same thing on the Bethe lattice, where you can go very close to the transition and still trust into this leading or expansion. Then you just see flat and then taking up. So whether this is a true effect so far, we cannot really prove. But I have somehow a suspicion that it should be. But
yeah. So I thought the origin of the divergence of localization lengths in bosonic bipolar problems had to do with certain broken ferromagnets you expected, because there's a global mode. The symmetry is actually these. And if you break the symmetry, then you know that it's small enough momentum, the mode has to delocalize. So is there a sense in which your phase correlations are developed enough that you can somehow think that, that this is sort of, even though it's a, an insulator.
Yeah, okay.
Thinking of it as an insulator, is right. There a sense that there's long range space correlation?
Yeah, so I think of that as being somehow bosons like to propagate most at zero energy because they it's like propagating through local condensates.
Yeah.
And if you go to higher energy, you have to sort of go through higher excitations of these local condensates, and that's somehow not good. But then, okay, at this point, I cannot say really much more than what the leading term gives. If you take into account subleading terms, we haven't figured out how to always get this kind of behavior. And whether this is known that this is generic. Okay. I may be going a bit over time, so I should start coming to the end. So now this raises the question, if this is always like this, that the lowest energy excitation seems to be to have the longest localization length, then as you approach the transition, then it tells you that just the zero energy excitation will delocalize first. But then that imply that there is never any mobility edge in Bose insulators, meaning finite energy excitations that are already delocalized even though you're still in the insulator. The answer is, of course, not necessary. The only thing that we can really infer, presumably, is that initially here this goes up, but whether it goes down again, that we cannot tell. And there are trivial cases where you get this kind of physics. If the density of states of the disorder increases very much with energy, then there is no reason why at higher energy wouldn't delocalize already in the insulator. A particularly interesting and not so trivial case where this happens very automatically is if you look at a system of glassy bosons. But maybe this I keep for more private discussion. I don't want to go so much over time. So just to flash with this the idea, so instead of just looking at disorder plus hopping of hardcore bosons, I generate the disorder by a disordered interaction between the bosons. And if I put such a system onto a high connectivity lattice, then this term will generate me a glassy state with self-generated disorder. And now I can again look for the superfluid transition and for delocalization. And this is actually a model that you can solve exactly in the limit of large connectivity, and makes it a very interesting and appealing model. Where you can form some ideas. And the thing is, this is the phase diagram. So the thing is, in this model, you can very well have the situation that the localization length is larger at zero energy than at somewhat higher energy, but then it goes up. And here it may even diverge. And so there can be a finite mobility edge. And what then happens at the superfluid transition is that the zero energy excitations delocalize, but in the presence of already a mobility edge. That would be my scenario three of the beginning, scenario two, sorry. A final interesting aspect that I would like to mention, just for experts here, is that if you look at such a glassy model, and you look at the self-generated disorder and the density of states of this disorder, it has this famous Coulomb gap forming at zero energy. And now if you look at propagation in the presence of such disorder, which has this characteristic feature around zero energy, you find that you will trap a mobility edge very close to the chemical potential. And that is likely to be an important ingredient in trying to understand recent experiments by Yastani on localization in close to metal insulator transitions. Okay, and with that, I think I will not show you the actual calculations which gave us these results. If you're interested, please ask me. Just give you the punchline of the messages. So we developed this locator expansion, this expansion in the hopping for interacting systems in random fields. And it's much more general than just hardcore bosons. You can do also spin systems or soft core bosons, etc. And there are many more interesting effects that you can analyze with that. What we find is that bosons shrink their wave function in the magnetic field, fermions expand them, and that can be picked up by magnetoresistance. A very interesting, and to be better understood, effect is that the localization length in bosons seems to be largest at zero energy. And that would suggest that the superfluid transition is always pioneered by the zero energy excitations. But if you have a Coulomb gap from glass interactions, you can also have this kind of behavior. And that that can tell you that you may have a mobility edge close to zero energy, even in the insulator, and that this mobility edge is very close to the Fermi level, actually. So what follows next will be analysis of finite temperature, higher orders in the expansion, and trials to resum this sum over path and trying to get better grasp of the effects that we see so far. Okay, thank you.
Questions in Parkinson's.